Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to History Rage, the podcast where we unlock the anger with our historian community. The podcast where we light history's blue touch paper and then wait for the explosion. I am your regular host, Paul Bavel, and joining me this week, dear Ragers, I am happy to welcome Professor of International History and Co-Director of the Centre of Modern and Contemporary History at Liverpool John Moores University, and author of the book Rise of the Devils, Fear and the Origins of Modern Terrorism, Professor James Crossland. James, welcome to History Rage.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
You are welcome. Feeling angry?
Always.
Good.
Perpetually. Good. Why wouldn't I be?
Yeah.
Because of the news recently.
Yeah, exactly. You actually came to us, you were that angry as well. So. Okay, so let's dive in. So before we get into all the anger, let's talk a little bit about your background, your work, and how you landed in the particular field that you're in.
So I've been a professional historian for about a decade or so, and I've always researched very bad things. For whatever reason, it's been the maltreatment of POWs, the laws of armed conflict, and how they're generally not adhered to, or at least not as much as they should be.
Mm-hmm.
Looked at propaganda and subversion and political violence. And it was through that I started turning my attention towards terrorism a couple of years ago and really started sort of bringing a few different threads together, The sum of which was deciding I wanted to write a book about the origins of terrorism, and that turned out to be Rise of Devils.
Yeah. Yeah, so what, I mean, is it just one of those things that you kind of went into, you were looking in the general theme and you thought, that's actually, it's a lot more fascinating than it appears?
Well, I'd had an interest since, well, for a decade, before I was even a historian, I'd had an interest in terrorism and had sort of gone back to it every now and then, but then I'd been distracted by other equally horrible things.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was when I got the headspace and the time a couple of years back to actually sit down and say, oh, you know, I've been stewing on this for some years now. I got a lot of ideas. I want to get them down. And at that point, the book basically wrote itself, which is always a happy outcome.
Yeah, I wish I could find something that writes itself. That's why I have all the ideas, but none of the writing.
It's the time. It's finding the time.
And oh,
the
hell yeah.
Just do their thing.
Yeah, it's also finding a long enough gap between two ideas to keep
that
me focused.
Well, as well. Yes. Always a tough one.
Okay, so let's light that blue touch paper then. Let's light the fuse and kick this off. So you've given us a few hints there, but what is the one thing you wish everyone would just stop believing?
I wish people would stop thinking that terrorism began on the morning of September 11th, 2001, or that it began with the Troubles, 1960s through the 1990s, or that it began when planes started getting hijacked in a sort of endemic fashion in the 1970s. Fun fact on that, first plane hijack was actually in 1931 that is for political purposes, by revolutionaries. So even that wasn't new when it was happening. It was in Peru. A bunch of revolutionaries, about 10 of them, that took over a plane. So even that wasn't new when it really, became a thing in the 1970s. I think that people have always looked at terrorism through the lens of the era through which they live. And there's a tendency to think that this is so unique and this is so different. And what I found, very quickly when I started thinking about the history of terrorism was that, there's a lot of this that is not new. A lot of this is really repetitive. Human beings are not smart. We don't learn from the past. This stuff just keeps getting repeated. And it was that mindset that got me thinking, I want to sort of correct this impression that each new epoch of terrorism is in some way unique, and to really kind of take it back and to find all these things from the past that are actually very reminiscent of or very cognizant of the present.
So how far back do you go?
So origin story here. I'll give you the origin story for Rise of Devils, and this will get us to where we need to be. And this is the source of the thing that pisses me off. So the morning of September 11th, 2001, I get a text. I remember this clear as day. I get a text from my boss that says the Pentagon is on fire. Call me. Okay. I remember that, and I remember all the events that happened in the next 24 hours. And then in the days and the weeks and the months that follow, there's this refrain. This all these pundits, parade of pundits, talking heads, all saying basically the same thing, variations on a theme. And that theme is nothing like this has ever happened before. This scale of disaster, the scale of fear that we've all got, completely unprecedented in human history. And I was not a historian. Okay. I wasn't even a history student. I hadn't gone back to uni. I was working in the real world. Yeah. Even then I could think to myself, well, this is horseshit. This stuff has had to have been around longer. So I started thinking about this, as I say, like going back over the course of the next 2 decades or so. I kept coming back and sort of thinking about terrorism and reading up on it and so forth, and just delving back in. By the time I decided I was going to write this book, I realized that a lot of historians who'd been writing through that lens of post-9/11 world, a lot of them who were trying to find where this started, where modern terrorism started, the kind of terrorism we'd recognize in the post-9/11 world, most of them landed about the 1890s or so.
Yeah.
And that's because that's when you've got anarchist terrorism, extreme ideology with violent adherence, blowing up soft targets across the world, global phenomenon. It resonates, right? It feels the same to the post-9/11 world. And me being the kind of historian who tells his students that, there's nothing new in history except the internet. We really haven't invented anything new for some time. I thought to myself, 1890 isn't even that far back. So I kept going further and further back, and I eventually landed on the 1850s. As the time when modern terrorism starts. And the premise of Rise of Devils was looking at how that starting point goes up to around about the outbreak of the First World War.
Yeah.
And in that period, everything from terrorist tactics to the way in which terrorist groups are formed, some methods of counterterrorism, the anxiety, the role played by mass media, all this stuff that we all know, that we all think is very contemporary, all of that basically happened from the period of the 1850s through to the First World War. So that's my starting point. And the thing that just gets me so annoyed is that there's an entire history there that tells us that we've been here before, and so few people know it. It just sits there and gathers dust, and hence the source of my disgruntlement.
So a couple of questions to throw in there then. First of all, if you're talking about modern terrorism, we all have our different ideas what that is and possibly even where it starts. And so how would you kind of give a definition of terrorism from your view?
Easy question. Yeah, look, terrorism is a subjective term, and you can make case for what a terrorist is from whatever angle you want, to be honest. When I sat down to write this, I had to come up with a definition, obviously, otherwise the whole purpose would be futile. And so I thought to myself, what does the normal person on the street think terrorism is? What do they think it looks like? What are we told that it looks like? And the definition I came up with was that it's a non-state actor using violence or threat of same to further a political cause.
Mm-hmm.
Different people will define it differently, and they'll write different books based on that definition. That is 110% fine. That's cool. But for me, that was what I wanted to get at, because I think that's how most people interpret a modern terrorist and what a modern terrorist is. So that's what I mean when I say modern. That for me, that's the starting point, is finding that particular representation of a terrorist in history.
Okay, so you start in the mid-19th century then. What happens? Who and how?
All right, so a couple of things. Terrorists need attention, right? If you set off a bomb, no one reports on it, no one gets scared of it, then you've done some violence, but you ain't terrorized it. And that's a key point here. There'd been bombings before in history. You know, the gunpowder plot is the one that most people think of as a kind of proto-terrorist act in England. But the media attention required to make terrorism go global, I think, is a really key ingredient to modern terrorism. It's the fuel that keeps this stuff going in many ways, the attention. Because when you get media attention, particularly, you know, sensationalistic, hyperbolic, you know, dangerously, scandalously poor media attention, you are both heightening the fear of whatever act you've committed, and you're probably going to inspire emulators. And these are two key themes that come out of a lot of terrorist attacks, two key goals. And in the 1850s, we've got the telegraph is starting to come in. We've got undersea cables being laid. We've got the start of the kind of global connectivity and the ability to move information around the world quite relatively fast, certainly by the standards of the time. That's starting to come in. Same time, various countries, there are censorship rules being lessened. There are taxes being repealed, and you're getting new newspapers being published. Printing is becoming easier and cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
There's literacy rates are going up. You've got the start of a newspaper reading public that is growing, and the start of really the kind of global media nightmare that we all live in today, the sinews of the 24/7 news cycle and fake news and tabloid news, or yellow press as it came to be known at the time. All of that is starting in the 1850s. So that's one key ingredient. The other thing that's happening is hell of a lot of wars. Crimean War, then we're going into the American Civil War, wars of Italian and German unification, and wars bring with them innovations in weapons. First machine guns are being invented. Crimean War, you got some guy positing the idea of using chlorine shells. It's the start of chemical warfare. You've got IEDs and new forms of explosive material being pioneered, and one of which is really important, which I depict as the first terrorist super weapon, is something called the Orsini bomb, which is a percussion-detonated hand grenade. Percussion-detonated meaning that it hits a hard surface, it goes bang.
Yeah.
Don't need a fuse, don't need a timer. And so that comes out of this period as well, and that's a really integral part of what really caps off the start point for me of modern terrorism, which, if you want, if your names, dates, places kind of guy, it's an Italian nationalist called Felice Orsini on the streets of Paris on the evening of the 14th of January, 1858, using the Orsini bomb, which he invents, to try and kill Emperor Napoleon III. And in the process, not just kill him, it's not just a standard issue regicide, he's trying to create a terrorist response. He wants to scare the Parisian public. He wants to put the fear of God into emperors across Europe. He wants to strike Napoleon as a symbol of the kind of conservative order. And he wants to demonstrate this idea that he and his team of bombers, there's four of them, one of them pikes at the last minute, there's three bombs that get thrown. You know, three men with bombs they made in their kitchen can create all of this chaos. That was the message that was trying to be sent. It sounds like something that could happen today. And so that's where I start the story in Rise of the Devils.
So what's his sort of ideology beyond just blowing Napoleon III into several very tender French pieces?
Well, it's a complicated one in that he's an Italian nationalist, Orsini. He's of the same ilk that Giuseppe Garibaldi comes from.
Mm-hmm.
But he's going about it a slightly different way, with a direct terrorist attack rather than a sort of grinding war of insurgency. His idea is quite simple. If you kill Napoleon, you are taking away the main Catholic backer of the Pope. Napoleon has the largest army in Europe at this time, at least in Western Europe. And you take away the Pope's main backer, and you can engender this struggle for Italian independence. That's it in a nutshell.
Yeah.
But as I say, there's more to it than that, because Napoleon, along with his other emperors, you know, Franz Joseph of Austria and the Tsar, they're seen as being part of this corrupt system that that Orsini and various other nationalists of this era, it doesn't matter what region of Europe they're fighting for the independence of, they all share this view that these bastards have got to go. And so that's the message he's trying to put out there by striking at Napoleon, which, just in case anyone doesn't know, he does not succeed. Napoleon III survives because a shrapnel grenade, which the Orsini bomb was, is a pretty shit weapon for assassinating someone when they're in a big, heavy wooden royal coach. But it is very good if you want to create a terrorist attack. And this was the other aspect to this. When Orsini throws these bombs, he knows damn well he's throwing them into a crowd of people, well-wishers, who are around Napoleon's carriage at the time. 8 people die, 150 are wounded.
Yeah.
But the primary target walks away relatively unscathed.
That's quite kind of early Victorian and so forth. Have you got any other examples of this style of terrorism being performed within the Victorian period?
Oh, plenty.
Go for it.
The thing about Orsini is he leaves a legacy. He gets beheaded for the attempt on Napoleon, and he becomes somewhat of a martyr, and he becomes a transnational martyr. There are people who are fighting against slavery in the United States who look to Orsini and say, this guy's got the right idea. There are nihilists in Russia who want to kill the Tsar, who say, this guy's got the right idea. There's even a particular group of nihilists who have the charming name of Hell.
Good name.
Fantastic. Yeah. No subtlety there. they actually try to get the plans for the Orsini bomb, because they're like, well, let's use this on the Tsar. Some Polish nationalists use an Orsini bomb on the viceroy of Warsaw, who's controlling Poland on behalf of the Tsar at this time. So you do get these kind of copycats in many ways coming out. But even into the 1890s, you've got anarchist bombers and assassins, the spate of assassinations by anarchists in the 1880s and 1890s. We're talking kings, we're talking empresses.
Queen Victoria has something like about
Queen Victoria has, I mean, she has attempts, but hers are not successful. Others are. There are some big scalps that are claimed. And in the midst of all this, the shadow of Orsini kind of hangs over a lot of this. A lot of the bombs that are used have an Orsini design. There's a bombing, it's a soft target bombing at theater in Barcelona, 1894 off the top of my head, that uses an Orsini bomb or a couple of Orsini bombs charged with dynamite. The guy, anarchist, throws them off the balcony into the orchestra pit, and they, you know, hit something hard and boom, and it's, you know, a terrifying scene. So the means by which his attack, you know, the lone man with the bomb is emulated is really quite widespread. You get Chinese anarchist suicide bombers in the early 1900s who are basically reading out of Orsini's playbook. That's
interesting, because I would have been very much guilty of thinking that the suicide bomber is the kind of modern phenomenon, but you're telling me that it isn't.
Well, that probably the most important in terms of being what we call a terrorist spectacular, which is a 9/11 thing, something that is designed to grab maximum global attention, to shake the foundations of what, you know, people believe in, to engender the most amount of fear. The prime candidate for that during this era that I look at, it happens in 1881 on the streets of St. Petersburg, when Tsar Alexander II is murdered by a nihilist who's from a terrorist group called Narodna Volya, or the People's Will. And the guy who kills him is arguably the world's first suicide bomber. There's some debate on whether or not this guy actually believed he was committing suicide, or, you know, zigged when he should have zagged. But the story goes that he's got an IED clutched to his chest, which is of an Orsini style. It's percussion detonated, dynamite charged. He's rushing at the Tsar. And depending on there's different versions of the story, but he either sort of throws it rather limply and he doesn't have enough reach, so he ends up dying in the blast, or he just rushes at the Tsar, leaps at him, and they both, you know, are taken out. Either way, it's a good candidate for the world's first suicide bombing, and it's certainly a spectacular assassination, grabs global headlines, makes a household name out of the people's will. They become the Al-Qaeda of the day in terms of being this a sort of brand of terrorism, if you like, the boogeyman, the one we must all fear.
Yeah.
It's one of the many moments in Rise of Devils when I'm writing it, thinking to myself, am I in the 19th century or am I in the 21st century? It's so eerily familiar.
Yeah, I suppose if you think about it, 9/11 was 2001?
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking 22 years ago. And even now, we still have to jump through all the same hoops in airport security because of that. If you wanted to create a legacy, you know, not gonna go pro Al-Qaeda here, but that was a success.
Yeah. I mean, we can both, I'm sure, remember the days when you could get on a plane and you didn't have all that. It's one of the many, many legacies. And there's so, when you start thinking about them, you realize there are so many that just little things that kind of build up over time. And that is a classic thing of, you know, that how much more tension, how much more anxiety are there in airports, even to this day, than there once were?
How much, in fact, terror is there?
Yes.
Okay. So while we're on the subject of 9/11 and the response for it, then you sort of talk in the book, in 1881, the New York Times advocates for the war on terror. Mm. Like I thought that was a new thing as well.
No, George W., not an original, I'm afraid.
It didn't strike me as a man who had original ideas.
No. So there is a caveat to this. The MIT runs a headline that says war on terrorism because they understood the English language better than George W. Bush.
Yeah.
But that quibble aside, it is effectively the same thing. So, 1881, this headline is run. Now, 1881 is a really important year in the history of terrorism. And it's because not only do we get the aforementioned assassination of the Tsar, which is the culmination of this campaign that the Rondavolia have been on since 1879. They've been trying to kill the Tsar. There are about a dozen attempts or so on his life. Smuggled a time bomb into the Winter Palace, bombed his yacht, bombed his train, you know, all this. And they finally get their man, as mentioned, with a suicide bomber. So you have that happening. At the same time, the first terrorist campaign to be conducted, and I mean campaign in terms of a strategic bombing campaign, to be conducted on British soil starts in 1881, mm-hmm. the so-called Dynamite War, which is
That's a great title.
It does what it says on the tin. It's a campaign of dynamiting that's run from the United States by a group called the United Irishmen. They're then joined by another group of Fenians called the Clan na Gael. And there's about 15 or so bombings between 1881 and 1885. Tube stations, gas works. They try to blow up the town hall in Liverpool. They try to blow up the Mansion House in London. And this kicks off but not the actual campaign starts with the bombing in Manchester and Salford Barracks. It kicks off not long after, around about the same time, in fact, as the death of the Tsar. And in this same year, in the summer, there's an anarchist congress in London where some of the more violently minded anarchists, because not all anarchists were, but mm-hmm. the vocal minority, it's always the vocal minority you've got to watch out for. They start talking about how we need to use a campaign of propaganda of the deed. So using dynamite to propagandize our message and to recruit to the cause and to create terror. Basic terrorist strategy. This is all happening in the first 6 months or so of 1881. And it's specifically in response to the Tsar's death, because as I mentioned, that's the big one.
Mm-hmm.
That's what leads to the New York Times' headline. But it is a very timely call because you've got Fenians, nihilists, and anarchists all in this year, all kind of saying, you know what? Dynamite, bombing, fear. This will further our causes. These are all different causes as well. Mm. These are all different, you know, ideologies, different objectives.
They would probably, if they met, bomb each other.
This is the fun thing that I really went down a rabbit hole with in Rise of Devils was that the police had some absolutely batshit theories about how this lot are all in cahoots. Fenians and nihilists and anarchists and socialists, oh my, they're all gathered together in these underground catacombs with, you know, hoods on, all you know, involved in some kind of diabolical conspiracy. This was a pervasive theory, and it was held, and again, held cynically perhaps to, perhaps, you know, get funding increase for certain police precincts and things like that. But it was a pervasive theory amongst a number of people at this time. And I really delve into it in Riders of Devils because it influences the police response, the media depictions, and some of the terrorist groups themselves actually lean into it. Mm. Some of the Fenians kind of make a show of making it seem like they're in league with the nihilists, where we've got a nihilist bomber who is training us in how to build our bombs, stuff like that. Because they know that it just ups the terror. It creates this, it taps into this fear. You know, everyone's frightened of conspiracy theories. Again, something that is not new. One of the many things that, as I say, when I was writing this, I kept thinking to myself, you know, Jesus, what century am I in? It's hard to tell at the time.
Check if it's carriages or cars, give you a clue.
That's
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So in that war on terrorism, then, what was the sort of response? What happened?
Well, it's somewhat piecemeal because you don't have proper cooperation between various police organizations in different countries. So there's no Interpol yet. Mm. There's nothing like that.
Doesn't it predate the London Met?
Well, so in 1883, Special Branch is formed, right, as a division of the Met. And Special Branch is the first counter-terrorist organization in Britain. And it's formed in 1883 because that's right smack dab in the middle of the Dynamite War. So it's formed to counter Fenian attacks. They then go on to go after anarchists. And then in the 20th century, they target communists as well. So it starts the ball rolling in Britain in many ways, the Dynamite War, in terms of counter-terrorism, although a lot of the sort of counter-terrorism techniques, for want of a better term, have already been pioneered in the colonies through some pretty brutal forms of colonial policing. So you've got some of that that's being brought in. In Russia, you've got the Okhrana, which are the great, 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 great. Maybe there's another great on there. Granddaddy of the KGB, what comes the FSB today and all that. Yep. So the Russian secret police. You've also got a fantastically insane group that forms in the wake of the Tsar's death, which I spend some time on in the book. They're called the Holy Brotherhood. And these guys are these sort of reactionary lunatics, for want of a better term, who get together and decide, you know what, we're going to counter the terrorists with terrorism. So if the terrorists are these secret societies that are all gathering and everything else in the nefarious, we're going to do that as well. We're going to have our own oaths. We're going to have our passwords. We're going to gather in secret and cavort around and all this. And we're going to strike back at the terrorists with terror. We're going to assassinate them. We're going to, you know, seek them out and murder them. And this whole thing is basically a scam. It kind of lasts for a couple of months and then peters out and they all get to feel very important for a bit. So you get these kind of, you know, bizarre sort of vigilante type responses. And then you've got the Prefecture of Paris Police as well is doing a fair bit of this time. In the States, you've got Pinkerton Detective Agency, which gets involved in strike breaking and sort of, you know, I guess, forms of what could loosely be called anti-radical policing, let's call it that. Yeah. So they're all kind of piecemeal, but then something happens in 1898 Empress Elizabeth of Austria, who is kind of contemporizes, I guess she's like the Princess Diana of her time.
Yeah.
Everyone loves this woman. She's glamorous. She's beautiful. She seems like a good egg. And she's stabbed to death on the shores of Lake Geneva by an anarchist, Italian anarchist, if I remember correctly. So an Italian anarchist kills an Austrian monarch in Switzerland. We have ourselves an international terrorist incident that, again, grabs headlines because she is beloved.
Yeah.
And also she's one of the many monarchs I mentioned before is killed by anarchists during this period. And she's the straw that breaks the camel's back. In the wake of her death, a couple of weeks later, there's a Congress in Rome in 1898, the Rome Anti-Anarchist Congress. And it's interesting that it's called anti-anarchist because it is, in fact, an anti-terrorist Congress. It's the first international gathering of police to try to figure out, okay, this is an international problem. We need to tackle it internationally. We need to cooperate. They come out of this with some pretty new ideas, reasonably new ideas. Let's do mugshots of suspected terrorists so that we know who we're looking for. Let's exchange information. So the start of intelligence exchange, which is absolutely vital, counter terrorist policing today. And there's also a kind of anti-immigration thing that comes out of this as well. You get a number of states passing in anti-immigration laws in the years later, because it's found by this time, and this is another contemporary resonance, that it's immigrant communities that harbor terrorists, obviously. That's where the anarchists are. They're in amongst diaspora in various that have come from afar. That's a widespread prejudice that informs the policing response. So really, you don't get the actual war on terror as an international thing happening until about 1898, but there are all kinds of bits and pieces that lead up to it from really about the 1860s onwards.
So going from that 1898 conference on policing then, where they all decide, right, we're going to get coordinated with this, you know, what actions do we see on the ground?
Well, there's some intelligence sharing. There is a normalization of things like, for example, taking mugshots, as mentioned. There's a universally accepted definition of what an anarchist is. And this is another thing that was very eerie, thinking about how the terrorists or Islamic fundamentalists in the wake of 9/11, you know, there's this thing of, well, we're not going to treat these people as criminals. They're terrorists. There's a difference. And there's this sort of semantic wordplay that happens in the legal field. What happens after 1898 is you basically get anyone who's an anarchist is regarded as a terrorist. And this is a very, you know, discriminatory blanket thing, because as mentioned, there's actually a raging row amongst the anarchist community at this time about whether or not terrorism is something that we should be doing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people saying, actually, this makes us look bad. You know, if anarchists are the people who are blowing up cafes and shopping malls, then who the hell is going to follow our ideology? You know, sensible thinking.
Yeah.
So the actual effects of the Rome Congress are more in what the precedent it sets rather than what it actually achieves. It sets a precedent for international cooperation that leads into things like Europol, Interpol, and so forth in the century to come. Mm-hmm. It normalizes this idea of intelligence sharing. And it does also highlight that this is an international problem, which by the end of the 19th century, it has become one. You know, I look at the development of different types of terrorism in various countries in the first half or so of Rise of Devils. And then the story goes on, it becomes more international because the terrorist ethos becomes more international. Terrorists start learning from each other, whether they're in Japan learning from French anarchists or Russian socialists, or whether they're, you know, Russians learning from the French or Americans learning from the Spanish or the Italians, whatever it is. It becomes this learned experience, but it becomes more internationalized. And as the terrorists become more global, so does the police response.
Okay, so this first terrorist wave that you're discussing then, what actually brings it to an end?
Combination of things. One is the aforementioned argument amongst the anarchists and some of the sort of elder statesmen, if you like, of the anarchist movement and stateswomen for that matter, sort of come out and say, well, actually, we need to stop doing this. This is dumb, which I think has some effect. There's also some really equally dumb policing measures. There are these mass trials. The French have a mass trial in the 1890s where they try to put anyone who's ever kind of picked up an anarchist pamphlet, try to put them on trial and say, just because these people are thinking this means they are going to commit a terrorist act. a whole bunch of people are put on trial of this, and it's a public trial. And the idea is that it's meant to get the public on side with this. And the trial is a complete fiasco for the prosecution, who look at it and the public look at it and say, well, this is nonsense. These people aren't criminals. So the fear, I think, of terrorism subsides a bit as the decades wear on, and it becomes apparent that the threat might have just possibly been inflated a bit by the police, by these conspiracy theorists, by the media peddling all this nonsense. And once the fear goes down, the actual temperature comes down a bit, and you get less of the attacks because they don't seem to be creating as much fear. Mm-hmm. You get a petering out of various movements. The nihilist movement in Russia that was really big in the 1870s, 1880s, that's basically falls apart and morphs into what becomes the Bolsheviks, the Mensheviks, and so forth, the inheritors of the revolutionary tradition in Russia. You get a lot of anarchists moving more towards less the propaganda of the deed and more trying to organize along what are, broadly speaking, more sort of socialist ideas and trying to actually win political power rather than seize it through violence. It's almost like there's a few years where everyone kind of loses the plot, and then there's this moving back towards an equilibrium where radical politics becomes a little less radical, little more conventional, but not quite so violent. It doesn't happen everywhere. In Russia in the early 1900s, Russia is a bloodbath in the early 1900s. You've got terrorists of all shades, anarchists, socialists, these people called the motiveless terrorists, who are just people who like to go around blowing stuff up.
Yeah.
And you've got, and the flip side of the coin, the state gets involved in terrorism as well. They kind of fund these sort of anti-Semitic bully boy squads who go around, you know, beating up Jews because they believe that Jews are the terrorists.
Again, diaspora, immigrant community.
Yeah, all that stuff. So it doesn't happen everywhere. It's not like there's this grand subsidence, but I do think that the worst of the fear, the panic, the conspiracy theories all ebb away. And then the other thing that happens, which stops a lot of stuff, is the First World War.
Yeah, which is, of course, caused by a terrorist act, really.
Yeah, I had to end Rise of Devils with On the Streets of Sarajevo. I mean, that's the culmination. There are people who are part of Young Bosnia, part of Gabilo Princep's group. There's an anarchist in amongst there, the guy who throws the bombs that don't succeed in the first attack. He's an anarchist. And they've all read about the Fenians. They've all read about the anarchists of the previous generations. They know about the nihilists. They know about Narodnaya. They know all this. They're the inheritors of that revolutionary tradition, the guys who kill Franz Ferdinand. And again, their motives are different. They got their own regional concerns and everything else. But they are, you know, the last in that sort of line of that first epoch of terrorism. They're very much the apotheosis of that. They're the culmination of that. So yeah. It's a good place it's also just a handy place to end, because it's not like terrorism goes away after 1914. Obviously there's a renewal of anarchist attacks. Wall Street is bombed. The first car bomb is detonated on Wall Street in 1920. Probably by anarchists. We don't know to this day, but more than likely there are Italian anarchists. Mm. So it all starts again. And there are even, you know, terrorist attacks during the war itself. But for the most part, the worst of it ebbs for a time.
Yeah. Is there an element to say that when you see the carnage that a terrorist act caused of the world, if you want to pin it on the terrorist act, I appreciate out there is a debate that all those countries were looking for a reason to knock lumps out of each other.
A little debate, a little one, you know, yeah.
But having seen that, then that the terrorists go, yeah, probably doesn't achieve what we wanted to achieve.
Yeah, I think part of what can sometimes, it can cut both ways. Sometimes a terrorist attack that's not successful, or Orsini being a good example, does nonetheless inspire. It really depends on what you are trying to achieve. Sometimes the act itself and its original intention isn't quite as important as how it's depicted in the legacy. And this is why I spend so much time in Rise of Devils talking about how the media depicts it, because the media is the media are the bastards in this. They really are. Then as now, the extent to which you can inflate a threat, the extent to which you can do the terrorist job for them and create fear that doesn't necessarily need to be there, fear that is disproportionate to the act itself, that's on the press.
Yeah.
And they revel in it in this period. Some of the headlines, people piss and moan about the, you know, fake news today and tabloid journalism. You spend a couple of years like I did pouring through these newspapers from the 19th century and then get back to me. You know, it's, my brain was mush at the end of that. Just nonsense, just wall-to-wall garbage. You know, literal fake news, just making stuff up about attacks that never happened, bombers that never existed, fatalities that aren't there.
I remember actually looking at suffragettes, who to some extent you can maybe able to call those, but there was there was a whole thing in the suffragette newsletter about this martyr to the cause that had been killed by a bouncer at a liberal club, having been thrown. This guy never existed. Not only could I find no trace of the incident, but it's like there's never an issue of a birth certificate, a death certificate for this guy. It's just not there.
This whole era is replete with this stuff. And one of the things I found was that the more you kind of delve into it, the more you realize that some of this stuff you've really got to question, you know, what happened. There's a classic example in 1866 where a nihilist tries to kill the Tsar. This is before he's actually killed. Comes up to him with a gun. Takes out the gun, he's at point blank range, he's about to fire it, and just as he pulls the trigger, so the story goes, a peasant, a man in rags nearby, reaches out, grabs his arm, knocks it down, the round gets fired into the pavement. Now, this is what was put out by the Russian press.
A trustworthy source at the best of times.
Yes, I mean, and it's a wonderful story, isn't it? Because this guy who's trying to kill the Tsar, he thinks he's liberating the peasantry. He's you know, it's poetry, and so the line from the Russian press was at the time, well, this guy, you know, obviously it's not just that he failed to kill the Tsar, but obviously his cause is bunk as well. Because at the end of the day, the peasant wanted to protect his holy Tsar, and gosh darn, ain't this wonderful. And I don't know if this guy existed. I mean, maybe he did. Maybe it happened. I mean, certainly the Tsar did not die that day. Something went wrong. Whether it went down like this, we don't know. It's a fantastic story. And it's not completely beyond the realms, because the Tsar did have his supporters amongst the peasantry, despite the whole state of things. But it's just such a perfect nonsense story that it can be nonsense or reality, and that's kind of the demonic beauty of it. You can take it either way.
I remember classically watching after 9/11, as you say, on the media doing the terrorist job for them. There was that classic thing that was in the bottom right hand corner of every Fox News outlet, which was, it had that little label on the screen that just said terror alert status high. It's like, do you really need to?
And you still see that to this day. And it's not just Fox.
No, that's it's absolutely
it's,
not.
It's any. I mean, they've all kind of taken the lead from, they were, you know, experts in this thing of if you, there were times there in the early aughts where if you left, you know, cable news going, it would burn, you know, be afraid into your television set, basically, because it's just there on the Chiron at the bottom constantly, you know, be very afraid of everything. If there's one thing doing this book has taught me, is that this is a natural human response. Yep. You know, we overreact, we panic. It's why terrorism is still seen as an effective strategy by a number of people, because of that. It evokes a human response. But taking that minute to actually think about it and kind of, you know, think about what this actually is and what's trying to achieve. That was something that was very hard to find during this first war on terror, which again had a lot of resonance.
So to close us off then, if we've examined terrorism, let's take a bit of a moment in examining historical counterterrorism. So what have been the most effective and least effective approaches? And what can we learn from them today? Or what should we learn from them today that we're not?
So in Russia during this period, the general response to terrorist attack or an attempt on the Tsar, which was the form that most terrorist attacks took, is arrest the assailants, arrest their friends, arrest their families, arrest their families, friends, tennis partners, arrest their dog, arrest anyone who's ever been near them, and put them on show trial if possible, send them to Siberia, throw them in the Peter and Paul fortress. It's blanket draconianism. And it wasn't just the Russians. The French got into a lot of this as well. It was pretty common in Spain at various points with the anarchists. This kind of blanket policing was never effective. In Russia, it created this cycle of repression, retaliation. The nihilists who were arrested in the 1860s, they went on to inspire the people who formed the Narodna Volya in the 1870s. When they got wrapped up in the 1880s, they were held up as martyrs by the likes of Lenin, Trotsky, and so forth. Lenin's brother was actually part of Narodna Volya. He was killed, which may or may not have had something to do with Lenin being pissed off at the Russian state. Yeah. Don't know, just a guess. So this stuff comes around. The hammer fist approach, which was pretty common during this time, didn't really work. What did work to an extent was infiltration, the embedding of police spies into organizations. The actual success in wrapping up Narodna Volya in Russia was through police spies, through infiltration. They actually got, the Okhrana actually got a guy who basically ended up effectively running Narodna Volya, who was working for the Russian state. So that was, you know, pretty good outcome. Likewise, you know, the British had a super spy, a Victorian super spy, a man by the name of Henri Le Caron. His real name was Thomas Miller Beach. And he was infiltrated into the Fenians. When was he? Around about the late 1860s, I think, from memory. And he was there for a better part of a decade and telling them, you know, what color their underwear was. He knew everything. He was a quartermaster general, I think, of the Fenian army. So he knew how many rifles they had, how many bullets. He got well in there, and that helped a lot in the various counter-terrorist measures against the Irish Republican attempts. So the infiltration was one thing. The other thing that was not really learned in this period, although arguably towards the end of this period, to go back to your point about when did this stuff start to wrap up, one thing that did happen is, I think that the sensationalism in the news did kind of exhaust itself by the time we get to the early 19th century, to an extent, in various ways. The public became a bit more cynical about this idea that there's this vast, you know, horde of anarchists, you know, globally connected and plotting the civilization's downfall. A lot of people started looking at that and go, yeah, well, whatever. And started to take the piss out of it, quite frankly. And that was really important moment in terms of kind of defanging terrorism was when people started to realize that, yes, this is bad, but it's perhaps not as bad as we think. We perhaps shouldn't be as scared as we are, or as told that we are. And this is something that, if there's a legacy in this period that I think has been learned, although to go back to the theme in the wake of 9/11, not so much, but certainly since, I think the media has become a lot better behaved in the way that it reports on terrorist attacks. The details it withholds, the stuff that it won't say, is sometimes quite useful. Back in the day, I mean, after Orsini's bombing, there are newspapers publishing details of the bomb. any idiot can pick up a newspaper and go, here's a bomb. Oh, so it's got this in it. It's got this in it. It works like this. Splendid. I'll go get me one of them. You've got detailed breakdowns during the dynamite war in the British press of, you know, There's one attack. I think it was on on Piccadilly Station or Victoria, one of the two. And it's sort of, it's got like a diagram of this is where they planted the bomb, and this is how they did it, and this is how the dynamite fiends did this. So it's like you're giving people instruction, in that, you know. And this is just so mercifully, we don't get a lot of that anymore. Little things like this really do count, because as I say, it's about it. The more the ideas get out there, the more the dangerous information gets out of there. Obviously, social media is a beast of its own. Yep. Bandit country. You can't regulate that. But the mainstream media, I think, is a lot better behaved than it was back in the day regarding how it reports this stuff and the details that it is a bit more wary of.
Well, thank you very much, James. That was an absolute eye-opener. And I always particularly love to do a good Victorian episode as well, because it is one of our kind of overlooked periods of history, surprisingly.
It's a great period. I mean, there's so much to learn from it that is familiar to today. There's so much that just is strikingly similar to today.
But it has that beautiful level of batshit insane that it's historical enough to be cracker, but modern enough to be relatable, isn't it?
That's exactly it. I mean, it's another thing that's relatable. You know, it's as bizarre as our own times, and the stuff that comes out of it, you look at and you think that's just mad. But it makes writing about it engrossing, mm-hmm. and writing Rise of Devils was nothing if not engrossing. For the whole exercise.
Well, thank you very much. And if you're out there and you want to know more about this subject, then you can and should check out James's book, The Rise of Devils, Fear and Origins of Modern Terrorism. You'll be able to find that in the History Rage bookshop. And if you're wanting to follow a stream of modern terrorism as well, then of course you can always follow him on Twitter at Dr. J. Crossland, which I'm sure he would be engaging.
And thank you for still calling it Twitter.
Yes.
Do not succumb to the
I'm a Yorkshireman. I don't do rebrands.
Good man.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. We would really appreciate any reviews you could leave with us or for us with Apple, Podchaser or Amazon. You can follow us on Twitter at History Rage or individually. I am at Paul Bavel, and Kyle, when he returns, is at Kyle G History. If you're loving this, then please support us on Patreon. In return for your cherished £5 per month, we will give you early episodes, entry into all of our prize draws, the invite to put questions to future guests, and of course, the coveted History Rage mug. And you can subscribe at patreon.com/History Rage. But until next week, from all of us here, stay angry. Bye-bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.